Okay, I want to call the meeting to order, the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee. Members, today we are going to have testimony on the American Recovery and Reinvestment Bill of 2009, first of all by the Department of Education, then by the Department of Human Services, on the CCDF funds, and then finishing up with DHS. So I wanted to ask the Department of Ed to come forward and get ready to testify. I know for the members there's a variety of things happening tonight, so we have people kind of in and out. I hope people will stay as long as they can, because I think this is going to be a good presentation. Well, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, is Ms. Mueller, or are you going first? Miller?
Sure, Madam Chair, Lisa Miller, Minnesota Department of Education. I'm going to start the presentation here and give you kind of a, we're going to give you a general overview of the stimulus provisions that relate to the Department of Education and specifically how they relate to this Early Childhood Committee. I'm going to start by talking about the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund, and then Michelle will cover some of the funding streams that are related to programs under current law.
If you could bring the microphone a little bit closer, I don't know if it'll...
Sure.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yes, it's being taped, so
okay.
I appreciate it.
Under the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund, $53.6 billion is available to states. About $816 million of that amount, depending on which estimate you look at, that's just an estimate. We're still getting updated information. That amount is available to Minnesota. The state fiscal stabilization funds are allocated to states based 61% on the state's relative population of individuals aged 5 through 24 and 39% based on relative total population. The governor is required to allocate 81.8% of the $816 million to education. That includes K-12 education and post-secondary education. And also, as applicable, early childhood education programs and services. There are three priority uses for the funds in terms of how the governor is required to use the funds under this part of the stimulus bill. The first is to restore in fiscal year 9, 10, and 11 the level of state support for K-12 education to the greater of either fiscal year 2008 or 9. Second, the governor is required to allow any existing funding increases that are already in current law that were enacted prior to October 1st, 2008. And three, the governor is required to also restore funding for higher education to the level of either fiscal year 2008 or 9, whichever is greater. Moving on to the next slide, if the governor determines that the amount of funds to cover items 1 through 3 is insufficient, then those funds have to be allocated proportionate to the relative shortfall of those three items. If there are remaining funds after fulfilling items 1 through 3, then the funds will be allocated out to local education agencies under the Title I Part A formula. Moving on to the next slide, when local education agencies receive those funds, the allowable uses include anything under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, the Individuals with Disability Act, Carl Perkins, and the funding is also may be used for modernization, renovation, or repair of public school facilities. On the next slide, the governor is required to submit an application to the Secretary of Education, and in that application, we must assure that we've maintained effort for elementary and secondary education at least to the level of funding as in fiscal year 2006. The same requirement is included for higher education as for K-12 education. We must demonstrate improving achieving equity in teacher distribution under ESBA Section 1111B, 8C, and also that we're improving collections and use of data under the America Competes Act. There's also another pot of funding under the state fiscal stabilization fund. Actually, there are two additional sources of funding. One is the state incentive grant. Under this, the $4.35 billion is available to states, and the Secretary of Education may reserve 1% for administration. The governor is also required to submit an application for this funding, and Minnesota plans to do that. Each state that receives an incentive grant must use at least 50% of funding to provide districts with subgrants based on the Title I Part A formula. And finally, the other pot of funding under the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund is called the Innovative Fund. And this is a fund that, although states are not able to apply for this, districts or nonprofit organizations that partner with a local education agency or a consortium of school districts could apply. And under this fund, up to $650 million is available to establish the fund and recognize eligible entities. Moving on to the next slide, the Secretary must award the grant to entities that have made significant gains in closing the achievement gap. Entities that have exceeded state's annual measurable objectives for two or more years in academic achievements for all groups of students. Entities that have made significant improvement in other areas such as graduation rates or increased recruitment of highly qualified teachers, or that they have demonstrated a partnership with the private sector and that the private sector is willing to include matching funds. Moving on to the next slide, the work from the Innovation Fund must include allowing eligible entities to expand their work and service model for best practices, working in partnership with the private sector, and identifying and documenting best practices that can be taken to scale.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michelle Weber. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. In addition to the stabilization funds that are included in the federal stimulus bill, there also are funds to existing federal programs. There's funds to Title I Part A, and we are estimated to receive about $87 million for this. For the purposes of your interest with respect to early childhood, the funds are allocated to local education agencies, school districts, and charter schools in the state based on a formula, and at the local level, they can elect to spend the funding on early childhood services. Title II Part D funding is technology funds. We're estimated to receive about $5.8 million. And that is to local school districts also. At the currently in federal law, we're required to allocate 50% of the funding based on a formula and 50% on a competitive basis. Funding for this program has been significantly declining over the last several years, and last year the federal government did give flexibility to allow states to allocate all of the funds on a competitive basis. So we're awaiting guidance to see if they have any sort of provisions that would allow for that type of, for all of these funds to be allocated on a competitive basis, or if we're required to utilize 50% on a formula basis. For the McKinney-Vento funding, we are estimated to receive $612,000. This is actually one of the numbers that doesn't change on a daily basis. All the estimates we've seen seem to keep this consistent. This funding, states are allowed to either utilize a competitive process or a formula process, and because it's a small amount of money, we do use this on a competitive basis. We are also estimated to receive $27.2 million in school improvement funding, and that's for the purposes of helping schools that are in needs improvement, and we would anticipate doing this through a competitive process. For the Head Start funds administered through the Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level, the bill did include $2.1 billion. $1 billion is distributed through the Head Start formula, the federal level Head Start formula, and $1.1 billion is for competitive grants to expand early Head Start programs. All of the Head Start funds pass directly from the federal government to the local programs. They do not pass through the state agency. Of the $1 billion that will be distributed by the formula to existing programs, we're expected to receive about $7.8 million. And they do have certain provisions under the Head Start Act for how those funds are utilized. $4.9 million is targeted for cost of living increases as well as quality improvement. What this will allow is for programs to increase their per child rate. And what it may result in then is a decrease in the state-funded enrollment. And just to elaborate on that a little bit more, last year with the reauthorization of the Federal Head Start Act, there was provisions that allowed local programs to negotiate higher per cost per children rates. And the state funds for Head Start are also allocated based on that federal per child rate. So if they were able to negotiate a higher per cost per child, then their state, they are able to negotiate with the Department of Education also to get approval to increase their state-funded per-child rate. $2.9 million is targeted for, programs don't have to compete for this, but for expansion. $1.8 million would be for early Head Start and $1.1 million for regular Head Start. Of the $1.1 billion that's available nationally for early Head Start expansion, this would be a national competition that would be overseen by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Existing early Head Start programs in the state could apply to expand their services. Existing regular Head Start programs could apply, and also non-Head Start programs in Minnesota could apply to provide early Head Start services. With respect to special education funding through IDEA, our current allocations in Minnesota for Part D, Section 611, which serves children ages 3 to 21, is $180 million. Our current allocation for Part B, Section 619, for children ages 3 to 5, is $7.3 million. And our current annual allocation for Part C, Birth to 2, is $7 million. These are, on this slide, it's annual allocations. This next slide provides you with the total increase that was provided through the federal stimulus package, as well as on the right-hand side, that column provides you with the two-year increase that is expected to come to Minnesota under these three sections. Under federal special education funding, the initial guidance that we're receiving is that all existing federal regulations would apply. What that means is that the funds would have to be used for the excess cost of special education, and there would also be maintenance of effort provisions. There is a 50% rule in the IDEA regulations that allows local districts to treat 50% of any increase in federal funds as local funds for 1 year. These funds would also be subject, as the Title I funds would also be subject to the Tidings Amendment, which provides districts 27 months to obligate the funds. As indicated on the special education funds, they have to be used for excess costs, and they must be used to supplement and cannot be used to supplant state and local funds. Uses of the federal funds include staff, contracted services, staff development, supplies, equipment, early intervening services, and it cannot be used to cover any unreimbursed costs for staff that are funded with state categorical funds. And in Representative Greiling's committee last week, they talked a lot about what are one-time type expenditures that local school districts might be able to use these funds for, because they are one-time funds. On the maintenance of effort piece, I talked a little bit about the 50% rule. What this would provide is, with the increase in federal funding that they would receive through the federal stimulus package, they can treat 50% of those funds as local funds. That is just for 1 year. So it does create a bit of a cliff effect for the district. And also, for the 619B and the 611B funds, districts are allowed to use 15% for early intervening services. This slide provides an example of how the 50% rule would be applied. If you look at fiscal year 2009, They're receiving $200 in federal funds. Their minimum for state and local funds is $1,000. That's their maintenance of effort requirement. In fiscal year 10, they receive an additional $100, so they get $300. 50 of the additional $100 they could use as state and local funds. And then in fiscal year 11, it bumps back up to the $300, then requiring them to bump their maintenance of effort up to $1,000. So it is a one-time, one-year allowability under the federal funds. The 15% rule, as I mentioned, allows districts to utilize 15% of any funds less than 50% that they use for local purposes for early intervening services, and that can be for students, for services to students prior to them might being identified for special education. These are also applicable to the Tidings Amendment and allow 27 months for the expending of the funds. So if funds become available on July 1st of this year, they would have until September 30th of 2011 to obligate the funds and have till December 31st, 2011 to spend them down. The federal stimulus bill, as you are probably well aware, included some accountability provisions as well. And so we do have new reporting requirements on the use and distribution. We'll be required to track these funds separate from existing funds that we receive. We will be required to report the numbers of jobs saved or created, any tax increases that are averted because of the receipt of these funds. We will be required to report progress on our highly qualified teacher equitable distribution, and tuition fee increases that are imposed, and any actions taken to limit increases to students, and that's particularly with respect to higher education. We also will be required to report the extent to which public institutions of higher ed maintained, increased, or decreased enrollment of in-state students, including students eligible for financial aid. And we will be required to report a description of the modernization, renovation, and repair projects that are eligible for the state stabilization funds. And with that, I will pause for any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Members, are there questions? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You to testify, thank you for your testimony. And can you tell us, with the current governor's budget proposal, is it impacting dollars that we might secure from the federal package? That's just one question. I'll start with that.
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, we do not anticipate any problems with securing the federal funds. And the governor's, any changes that might need to be made will be made in the governor's supplemental budget.
Representative Ward?
So, are there more funds available based on a change that the governor could make?
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, not that I'm aware of. As far as I am aware, we are eligible for all of the funding that would be available to the state with respect to the education provisions. I'm not as familiar with any other provisions that might be in the state.
Thank you.
Ms. Weber, we have heard that in some of the committees that some of the funds may be turned down, but I've heard that that's, you know, under certain circumstances. So I guess in this case, not for this committee, is what we're hearing. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to sort out, since this is the Early Childhood Committee, which of these funds might be available for early childhood. It looks to me, I was looking at the state incentive grants. I don't know if that's, first of all, I guess I would have a question. Is the governor planning to apply? It says the governor can apply for those grants. Do you know if there's any attempt to apply for those particular stabilization grant or incentive grants?
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, we are planning to pursue every available resource that would be made for education. In terms of what those funds can be used for, we're desperately awaiting guidance from the U.S. Department of Education. We were promised it last week, and we've been promised it again this week, that would outline the types of things that states could apply for funds for.
That answers part of my first question. Madam Chair, I just want to pursue then. How about the Title I funding? Now, that normally has gone to the K-12 system, and I know in the Senate bill at the federal level there was some money in there for trying to put some into early childhood, and I don't think that passed through the Senate. Is the Title I money intended strictly for K-12, or is that also for early childhood?
Ms. Wilmer.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, yes, there was a provision in the Senate bill that specifically targeted funds to early childhood. The bill that ultimately passed did not include that specific target. However, under the general provisions of Title I, local education agencies can decide to utilize those funds for the purposes of early childhood. That decision is made at the local level, however.
Okay.
Representative Peterson.
And I see Head Start just gets unqualified money, which is great. I wish that we had a bit more of that. And then the special ed money on all three categories, it's 3 through 21, 3 through 5, and birth through 2. Are those fairly well set by law as to how much would be given in each category? I mean, it seems pretty wide when you've got 3 to 21 in Part B. How do you determine how much goes to each category?
Ms. Wilbur.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, the Part D Section 611 funds, the majority of those funds are allocated to school districts via a formula, and then they utilize those funds at the local level to provide additional services to children with special needs.
Okay.
The 619B funds, that also is the process for those. The majority does flow out to districts via formula, and they determine the services that are necessary. Under Part C, we have in Minnesota interagency early intervention committees. We have 95 of them throughout the state, many of which are school districts, and they provide coordinating services for children birth through the age of 2.
Okay.
Thank you.
Garland? Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson actually asked most of my questions, and I just have one then, and that is regarding Head Start. Ms. Weber, when we accept these funds from Head Start, and then we get another $7.8 million for Head Start, and then we go ahead and use them, and then the money's gone in the next biennium. And so how do you foresee there's just going to be a lot of, will it be just through attrition then that money can be ended, or will there have to be students that actually qualify that are cut off?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, I think what you may see happen if the federal government does not continue the level of support is that fewer children would not be served. Currently, children exit the program at age 5, so it could result in children exiting the program and no new children being served, and hopefully would not result in existing services being cut off to children that are being served. But I think at the local level, that's gonna vary. If I may also, I was requested by the committee administrator to talk about two things that I neglected to do, one of which is a match requirement for Head Start programs. They're required to provide a 80-20 match for 20% in local funds. Many of the programs in the state utilize volunteers to provide that match, as well as donated space to provide that match. They also, some programs do use their state allocation of Head Start funds. And under the conference committee report, the committee recommended to the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that they utilize their authority to waive that local match requirement. So we're waiting for guidance to see whether or not they might waive that match requirement. The other piece of information with these funds is that there will be funds available to support the early childhood advisory councils, the state councils that are established by the governors. Through a competitive grant program, states would have to apply for a minimum of $500,000, and that has a 70% match requirement. So rough math is, I believe, you'd have to allocate $1.2 million in state funds or private funds in order to leverage those federal funds that might be available.
Representative Kulik Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a question about the $1.1 billion for early Head Start expansion. This is national competition. Can you give me a little more on how a state competes for that? Do you have any more information on, I'm assuming it's not going to be, we all compete for the same $1.1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And what efforts will Minnesota make to compete for that?
Clover.
Madam Chair, Representative, because the federal Head Start funds do not flow through any state agency, they go directly to local programs. The local programs would make the determination about whether or not to apply for those funds. Because this would be an open competition and not limited just to existing Head Start programs, it's our understanding that non-Head Start programs could apply to provide early Head Start services in geographic areas of the state that are currently not served by existing early Head Start grantees.
Members, are there any other questions? Ms. Wilber, I was just wondering, because we have the budget forecast coming out next week and then we have this money, do you think that the governor is going to have to change his budget recommendations as a result of this bill or the forecast, I guess, for either one?
Madam Chair, I would expect that the federal stimulus funds would require change in the governor's budget. I'm not privy to the details of where those changes might occur. We do have to have approval from the state legislature in order to spend federal dollars, so we would definitely be including the increases in the existing programs in the governor's supplemental budget. We would wait at least the 20-day period before we actually spend any of those dollars.
Ms. Weber, do you have any idea when that supplemental budget would be coming out?
Madam Chair, I do not.
Interesting. Okay. Members, any other questions on this? Otherwise, we will move for Representative Downey.
I'm sorry. I hope I'm not asking overly basic questions here. But we had some preliminary advice from the Commissioner of Finance that there was a total of $671 million. In the fiscal stabilization education bucket, and I'm trying to do just some general math here. So if you go to your very, I guess it's your second slide, actually the first one with real numbers on it, the 816.5, that's an upward re-estimate based on a finer tooth comb, is that right?
Over. Madam Chair, Representative Downey, the 816.5 is the total stabilization funds to Minnesota. 81.8% of that goes through the education provision, so that's where the 600 and some odd million comes
okay.
from.
Thank you. And then in terms of prioritization, the governor must use the funds first for restoring K-12 and then elementary and secondary education and then higher ed. You mentioned that we'd be able to fully use the federal stimulus funds. Do you know, do those funds actually allow us to kind of go through 1, 2, and 3 to their fullest extent and therefore have money left over for the LEA activities?
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, our take on the fiscal stabilization funds, because they will be required, the first requirement is to restore any reductions in funding, is that we will need to wait and see what the legislative action is with respect to education.
Okay. And then last question then, it's slides 3 and 6. On slide 3, it talks about restoring support to the greater of FY 2008 or 2009. And then on slide 6, it talks about at least at such level as FY 2006. Am I not understanding the numbers correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, the 2006 figure is a maintenance of effort requirement at the state level in order for us to be eligible for the state stabilization funds. Then the use of the state stabilization funds is governed by restoring the level to the greater of 2008 or 2009.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. I think we are all learning this, and I think it's going to be a lot of learning through the process to see how this ultimately gets allocated. Representative Ward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question about the waiting list. Will any of the funds be used to cut down the waiting list, to eliminate the waiting list, to use for the waiting list?
Ms. Over.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, for Head Start, the waiting list for Head Start, is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, I would assume that that's what local programs would use the funds for. They would be available to serve additional children.
And
Representative Warren.
And I know that the for special ed allocation is to use for excess costs, not the supplant, but the supplement. And that is true, I'm assuming, also in early childhood. They're all education aspects.
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, I'm just going to look behind me and see if Head Start has a supplement, not supplant provision. The federal. Okay. We are not aware of a supplement, not supplant provision in the Head Start Act. But both the Title I funding and the IDEA funding have supplement, not supplant provisions.
Very good. Well, thank you. And I'm sure we'll be talking about this. Next, we are going to have a presentation on the from the Department of Human Services on the Child Care Development Fund. And then we're going to come back and talk about the American Resource and Reinvestment Plan for Department of Human Services. So if Deb Swenson and Sharika Filmick want to come forward. Members, we need to pass the minutes in the meantime. Representative Max, you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have. I move the minutes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Mack moves the approval of the minutes for February 17th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails, and the minutes for February 17th are approved. Just a reminder, members, that we will adjourn early on this Thursday. We'll probably get done by about 5:30. We also have parents and kids and providers coming in to Thursday's hearing, so that always makes for an interesting hearing, and hopefully they appreciate if you can take an interest in what they're doing and how they're involved. So, good. Well, welcome to the committee. Now, who's going to go first today?
I'm going to go first. My name is Sharika Tilnick, and I work for the Department of Human Services. I manage the Child Care Assistance Program, and I'm going to give you a general overview of the Child Care and Development Fund and kind of how that comes to Minnesota. One of the handouts that you got was second time when it's clean to show you is this chart, and it's the same chart that I gave you in an earlier presentation this year. And this chart is in the process of being updated. You'll note that the numbers on this chart are from federal fiscal year 2008, and we're in the process of updating this for the current Child Care and Development Fund plan process. As soon as the February forecast is released, this page will be released with all new numbers. So we'll make sure that you get that so that you have the presentation makes sense related to the numbers that are currently.
Ms. Kapila, can I ask you one question before you get started? Is I know we're going to do your presentation and then the stimulus bill presentation, but basically all the stimulus funds for, and Mr. Johnson will get into this, most of them are going through this fund, right?
My understanding.
Okay, so just members, that's just a heads up that we're doing this before that, knowing that all these, this new money will be coming for this fund.
There's a particular section of the stimulus package that is CCDF funding. So, and Mr. Johnson will tell you more about that. Okay, on this the chart that I handed out, I just wanted to point you to the goals and the purpose of the Child Care and Development Fund. We expect that any money, all money that we get right now, has to address these goals and purposes. Under the goals, the things that stand out for me when I'm thinking about policies in the child care programs are that the state has maximum flexibility to do the ones to do policies that best meet the needs of children and families. We have to promote parental choice and empower parents for making choices for their kids. We are encouraged to provide consumer education, again, to help inform parent choices. We provide child care to parents who are trying to achieve independence, and we are supported in our health and safety and licensing and registration standards. So those are the big goals of CCDF. And then the purpose generally is to increase the availability, affordability, and quality of child care services, and then there's more detail underneath that. The reason I wanted to just mention that is because every 2 years the state has to submit a plan to the federal government telling them how we're spending the money in the Child Care and Development Fund to achieve these goals and purposes. So there's lots of questions in that plan about exactly what we're doing to address the goals and purposes of the Act. And I just mentioned that we are in the process right now of doing the fiscal year 10 and 11 plans, and that we will have more information about that coming to you shortly. So the next, the Child Care and Development Funds are actually three funding streams, There's a mandatory fund, and each of the funding streams have separate requirements. There's the mandatory funding stream, the matching funding stream, and the discretionary funding stream. In total, those funding streams are about $78 million that comes to Minnesota through the Child Care and Development Fund. Under the mandatory funding stream, there's no maintenance of effort requirement as long as the TANF MOE is met. There's no state match required, and we have to obligate it by the end of the fiscal year that we receive it, the federal fiscal year that we receive it, and it's available until it's all spent. So those are the general requirements for the mandatory funds. The matching funds do have a maintenance of effort requirement, and we must contribute the state's dollars equal to the federal fiscal year 95 spending on AFDC-related child care. So that the maintenance of effort requirement hasn't changed. It's been the same since the CCDF started, and that's about $19.6 million. The state expenditures above the MOE will be matched at the federal medical assistance program rate, up to the limit of the matching funds available in the matching fund. And the funds must be obligated by the end of the federal fiscal year and spent by the end of the following fiscal year. So that's a little bit different than the mandatory funds, which don't have a deadline for spending. The discretionary funds have no state match requirements. They have to be obligated by the end of the succeeding federal fiscal year. So they have to be obligated within 2 years of the state, the date that the state receives them, and they have to be spent by the end of the second succeeding fiscal year. So it's the 3 year point at that one. TANF transfers that are made to the Child Care and Development Fund, which you know happens fairly frequently in Minnesota, become part of the discretionary fund stream. Now, there are a lot of regulations on related to the use of the CCDF funds. We are allowed to spend no more than 5% of the funds on state administrative expenditures. Minnesota currently spends less than that. That doesn't include the county administrative expenses. And in Minnesota, the county administrative expenses are part of the funding that we send to them for direct services, and they're related to the amounts that they send for direct services. There's a 4% minimum plus targeted funds that are required to be spent on quality and development activities. And Deb Swenson-Clatt is going to talk to you about how Minnesota spends with the quality and development activities. And then 70% of the mandatory and matching funds are required to be spent on direct services. Minnesota spends substantially more than that.
What's going? I mean, maybe it's just me, but are we supposed to be following along?
You have nothing to look at.
I wondered about that.
Giving you
I think we're all trying to figure that out. Is there any thought that we might get something after the meeting, maybe even that we could see that?
We could certainly give you those details.
Thank you.
The maintenance of effort requirement for the CCDF funds is currently at $19.7 million. State funds are used to meet this maintenance of effort requirement. These state funds may also be used to meet the TANF MOE requirement, and this is unusual in that state funds are used to draw down two federal funding sources. So we can use the same state funds to draw down two federal funding sources. There's a matching funds requirement. State funds are used to meet matching requirements. The current match is at 50%. The FMAP rate is 50%. And state child care funds that are spent in the child care assistance program above and beyond those required for the matching requirement are used to draw down TANF funding in Minnesota. And then the next piece is about the discretionary funds the discretionary funds include the quality and development funds, targeted funds, which are above the 4% set aside. So the targeted funds, the school-age child care targeted funds, the infant and toddler child targeted funds, and the quality expansion targeted funds are part of the discretionary funding stream. And then the 4%, the minimum of 4% set aside funds are required to be spent on eligible activities. And Deb is going to talk to you about what are eligible activities for those expenditures.
Thank you. pretty complex, I must say. I don't know if everybody's following this, but it is a little hard for us to follow this. So I hopefully we're getting it all. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deb Swenson-Klatt. I am with the Department of Human Services, Child Development Services Unit. So as Ms. Kotelnik said, I'm going to provide an overview of the CCDF quality funding in Minnesota, and I'll refer again to some of the information on this handout, but also just share with you some additional comments, and I have additional information to hand out if you're interested in more detail. The federal CCDF quality funds are a part of the $78 million that Sheree mentioned coming to Minnesota on an annual basis. Of course, the child care assistance funding or subsidy dollars are the largest part of that this pot of money, but CCDF funds also contain a significant investment for child care quality support. This funding has fluctuated slightly from year to year in recent years, but has averaged about $9 million since 2004. And if you look at this chart in the bottom left box, I do want to highlight some of the purposes there that are specific to the quality funds. The CCDF program requires that we support with our quality funds the purposes of enhancing the quality and increasing the supply of child care for all families, including those who receive no direct assistance under CCDF. So that means families who do not receive child care assistance. It requires that we provide parents with a broad range of options in addressing their child care needs, that we work to strengthen the role of the family in relating to and finding child care that meets their needs. We're also required to improve the quality of and the coordination among child care programs and other early childhood development programs. And finally, we are directed to use these funds to increase the availability of early childhood child care and before and after school services. As Sheree mentioned, there are some specific targeted funds that used to be called earmarks that are prescribed for us and requirements related to the use of the quality funds. And again, these are all part of that discretionary funding stream where there's no state match required and that we must obligate within and expend within that three-year period. So again, these requirements are for the quality funds that state must spend at least 4% of their total funds on activities to improve quality and availability. In fiscal year 09 in Minnesota, we spent 5.1% of our total funding on quality. And then in addition to that percentage, that quality set aside, we must also meet these targeted funds or earmarks. Those are prescribed to us in terms of dollar amounts, not percentages. So in fiscal year 09, out of that $9 million in total funding that we received for quality, $1.3 million must be spent on an infant toddler, towards activities supporting infant and toddler care. $220,000 must be spent for in support of school-age care and the CCRNR system in our state, and $2.2 million must be spent towards activities that would expand the supply of quality care. Those amounts also have not varied a lot in recent years, and so again, we must meet those targeted fund levels. We must meet the 4%. And I would say that in both cases, with the 4% set aside, we exceed that. We're currently spending 5.1%. With regard to the activities required in those targeted fund categories, we also not only meet, but we really exceed the amount of funding supporting those particular activities around infant toddlers, support, school age and CCR, CCR&R, and quality expansion. Even though it isn't the focus of our discussion today, I just note that we also do have state funding in Minnesota for child care quality, and this funding we specifically use to address activities outlined in state statutes around the operation of the child care resource and referral system, child care services grants, an accreditation reimbursement program, and child care financing grants. But we also use our federal funding to support those activities that are outlined in state statute. We blend both our federal and state funding to meet both the purposes of the federal plan and the state statutory requirements for child care quality. I'll just quickly describe the process that Sri alluded to around the development of the federal plan every 2 years. I think it's helpful in understanding that process because it is used to shape how we, as a state, direct the use of our quality funding. And while the plan is really more prescriptive when it comes to the child care assistance program, in many ways, the child care assistance program is taking what's in state statute and ensuring that it's reflected in the federal plan. With the quality funding, there's less prescription, and so it's important to us in this two-year process to ensure that we're moving towards the support of our larger goals for the federal plan, gathering public input, and then developing a budget that that will support that that plan. So the process for the plan that, again, we're in the midst of right now is that we begin by reviewing the current child care quality infrastructure needs, the state statute requirements, and look at current and new priorities. And certainly this year, the quality rating system and other related activities are front and center in our minds. We gather input on the plan from a variety of stakeholders throughout the fall and early winter, and then at this point in the year, we're beginning to draft the plan internally and prepare it for public review. So the public will be seeing that soon and then invited to participate in a public hearing that's slated for May 6th, I believe. Mm-hmm. Once that public hearing process and the process of gathering further input from you as legislators occurs, then we finalize the plan. It's due to the feds June 30th, and we at the same time are in the process of developing for the quality funds a budget for the next biennium based on that plan. So from year to year, that budgeting process and the biennial planning process provide flexibility for us in meeting new and emerging priorities, again, with respect to the rating system, but also certainly in years where we've had disasters in the state, we're able to, within the scope of the plan, respond to and support natural disasters and the child care infrastructure in the places in the state where that occurs. I say that over the course of recent years, the percentage of funding that we have dedicated as a state to different parts of the child care quality infrastructure haven't changed significantly. So when you look at funding for child care resource and referral, it really hasn't varied much. When you look at funding for the child care services grants, that's a program that I described to you earlier back in our program overview in January, that hasn't shifted much as well. With respect to our fiscal year 09 quality budget, I'll just briefly provide a couple of highlights because it might also help you understand how the child care development quality funds are used. What you see on this page is our estimates of our fiscal year 08 expenditures for child care quality with the set the targeted funds and the amount for the set aside. Again, in fiscal year 09, we use those funds in and pair them with our state quality funding to support our goals and priorities that are outlined in the federal plan and prescribed in state statute. In 09, as I mentioned earlier, our total federal funding for quality is $9 million, with those set-asides $1.3 million for infant and toddler, $220,000 for school-age and CCR&R, and $2.2 million for quality expansion. We use that an additional $1.3 million in state funding, so that we have a total funding for child care quality in Minnesota of $10.4 million. In 08 and 09, we also had additional one-time money for specific programs, including the pre-K allowance program, child care services grants, the Family Friend and Neighbor grant program, and the professional development system. So I think with that, I'll just end by saying, again, all of this funding goes together to support our overall goals. A quick revisiting of those goals, again, that we shared back in January, our consumer education about quality care, grants and financial support to providers, consultation, mentoring, and technical assistance and professional development. I think there's many ways to slice the quality budget. You can slice it in terms of the types of grantees that receive it, the types of program activities that we fund. Many of those activities are funded across the different targeted funds. So, for example, our child care services grant program that's defined in state statute, a portion of the funding for that is used is directed towards providers who serve infants and toddlers, so it helps meet our infant toddler targeted fund. Another portion is set aside for providers serving school-age children, so it helps meet that targeted fund, and the remainder of funding for that grant program goes to meet activities to expand quality, so it meets that targeted fund. In a similar way, training, a key and professional development, a key activity for us can be seen across those targeted fund categories. The funding can be seen across those targeted fund categories. So many different ways to slice the quality budget, and I hope this has been a helpful overview for you.
Everyone's grailing.
You know, people are always complaining about the CAICO finance budget being Byzantine and complicated, and I have to say, this does take the cake, you know. We have the new Minnesota Miracle to streamline and make more understandable ours, and I hope that this committee does something similarly, because I just wonder, does any, to either one of the testifiers, do we ever not get to spend any money because we have not parceled it out in all these ways, and is this in any way going to hamstring us with the federal money to have to run it through this very complicated process and program.
I can say that Minnesota is very proud that we have always spent all of our money, and when other states can't spend theirs, we are lined up to be able to take theirs also.
Madam
Chair, so that's good. At least you guys have got it figured out, but I'm just wondering if
other states don't feel the same way.
Has this developed over time so that it wasn't so complicated to begin with, but different legislators had different bills, all with good intention, and then we ended up with this very complicated process? Or how did we get to this point?
Ms. Katoma?
Madam Chair and Representative Bryan, I think that it's the federal regulations on this one and the multiple funding schemes from the federal level that make it complicated. And there were several separate funding streams for child care before the Welfare Reform Act was in place. One of them was the AFDC child care, and one of them was a child care and development block grant. I think there was even a transition year kind of a set aside in the in a different pot, and they kind of just tried to meld the pools into a block grant, but couldn't quite let go of the separateness of the funding streams and some of the characteristics of each of the ones that had existed beforehand.
And Madam Chair, I guess we don't need to pursue this, but just one last question. Since you have it figured out, you're obviously able to make sure we get all the money, but how much extra time and administrators do we need because it's so complicated compared to a simpler formula, or doesn't that seem to get in the way in that regard?
Ms. Cattoni?
Madam Chair, Representative Sparling, I think that this method of getting funds from the federal government is not unlike a lot of other federal funds that flow to the Department of Human Services, and they have a very strong financial management infrastructure that can support funding like this.
It's refreshing to have you on the committee, and because sometimes I think it's just me, but now we know there's two of us and more. I have to say there has to be a way to either translate this so it's easier for us or something, but don't you feel it's almost like another language that you're talking? That's how hard it is for us to understand this, and I've had many, many presentations on this. I want to take Representative Peterson's question away to move on, but I will just hang this out there because I've done this many a time. As Representative Greiling, we could look at, in some states, apparently the legislature gets very involved in how these funds are allocated. So that's something that we could also take a look at and have been taking a look at and may take a bigger look at so that we just have more say in the process. So, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm totally confused by the numbers, and it's a little bit difficult because I'm not sure how much we're spending now. I mean, we're getting the new numbers down here about those that are available for 2008 and the expenditures, and then this maintenance of effort in the future. I'm trying to figure out, will we have enough dollars in the future to do maintenance of effort, even if we get the funding? I guess that's one question. And then, does the agency plan to use the quality set aside for QRS or School Readiness Connection? Do you have plans for specific programs and some of these dollars that would be available?
Ms. Cohen?
The new funds that are coming to the state do not have a matching or an MOE requirement.
Oh, they don't.
So we don't have to worry about that for drawing down the new federal funds. And the department is always very careful to make sure that there are enough state funds in the child care assistance program to meet the match and MOE requirements that are necessary to draw down the funds that are available.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Peterson, I think in response to your question about the quality rating system and in response to earlier comments, I think that with respect to the quality funds, there's no question, I think, that the targeted funding and requirements get in the way, I think, of understanding how the quality funds can be used. I think that the requirement for the 4% minimum set aside is a little bit easier to understand. States simply must spend at least that amount of their total funding towards quality activities. So the hurdle is to ensure that we're meeting the purposes of those targeted funds
funding requirements in the areas of infant and toddler activities, school-age care, CCR&R, and quality expansion, but know at the same time that there's a lot of flexibility that we have in meeting those targeted funding requirements and in meeting the overall purposes of the quality requirements for the federal plan. And the quality rating system, I think, offers a lot of promising approaches, including potentially a framework for how to think about how we can use our quality funds in a more strategic and targeted way. A lot of what goes into making a quality rating system work, we think, from both our pilot in Minnesota and the experiences of other states, are activities that we're already doing in many respects with our quality funds. It is about consumer education. It's about professional development. It's about grants to support improved quality. It's about coaching and mentoring providers towards goals that we're identifying as really important through the indicators that we and the criteria for quality that we are setting forth in the rating system. So, yes, and as the rating system expands in Minnesota, I think that it might provide, again, a framework for understanding our quality funds that allows us to build on the infrastructure that we have created over a number of years and strengthen and further enhance the activities that we're already doing.
What I think we need to do, Representative Ward has a question. I want Mr. Johnson, if you could come down so we can start on your presentation, because we want to hear about how the funds are going to be spent in Department of Human Services. Representative Ward, do you want to, did you have a follow-up, Representative?
Oh, I just wanted to say, I think that's a yes.
Or maybe.
Representative Ward, and then we'll have Mr. Johnson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and just like you and Representative Gunning, I'm still trying to figure out underfund and overspend and what we talked about last week. So, having said that, we had I was on several legislative town hall tours or meetings this past week, and at one of these meetings, there was some providers there that talked about the quality rating system and just talked about the critical situations that child care providers are in, having people, not enough kids to serve and to be in their care and things as such. But in particular, one testifier who was a young college age woman that had a 4-year-old child was very. She gave great testimony about how important the child care assistance program was to her, and how in fact she. Turned her life around using the child care assistance program and her son's life, and was able to work 30 hours and still go to school and try to better herself and her son. It was really compelling testimony. So this was in a greater Minnesota area. So my question is, do the CCAP reimbursement levels ensure that equal access to quality child care statewide, and can you explain that?
Madam Chair and Representative Ward, the maximum rates established in the Child Care Assistance Program are based on the provider type. We do it on a market rate survey, and we survey licensed family child care programs and licensed center-based programs, and we establish maximum rates differently for those two categories of care in order to be closer to the cost of the actual types of care, and we also establish different rates for different age groups, because generally that's a different cost of care. The rates in the Child Care Assistance Program overall for all providers have not gone up significantly in recent years. We do measure the access that the current rates allow to providers in the state, so how many providers' rates fall under the maximum rates for the Child Care Assistance Program, and we track that. And we know that that's getting lower every year. There are less providers that our families can afford.
It has not, in our family profile, we follow the types of providers that parents choose, and the types of providers that they choose have not changed significantly in spite of the fact that the rates have been more compressed. And we also, in the child care assistance program, have two components that are designed to allow greater access to higher quality care. One of them is the credentialing bonus. It's up to 15% higher rates that we can pay to any licensed provider or legal non-licensed provider that has certain credentials that are in statute. Some of those are degrees, and some of those are NAEYC accreditation and things like that. And then we also have the pilot project for School Readiness Connections, where we have actually established agreements with providers who have high concentrations of low-income kids and are paying significantly higher rates, 25% higher rates, and are relaxing the child care assistance program policies so that they don't just wrap around the parents' work schedule, but they also allow kids to stay in care on a continuous basis over a long period of time. So it allows them to have the benefit of the continuity and the higher concentration of care. And the results, the interim evaluation is out on that project, and the final evaluation is due in December of 2009.
Thank you. Yeah, there's probably only one topic more complicated than CCDF, and that's child care market rates and how they're set. And we went through all the zip codes in the state, and they grouped them together, and we went through all the, it was amazing. It's just amazing. But I'm hoping if we have time, we'll have a presentation on that. There's full-time staff that work on that. So with that, I think thank you very much. And we just know we are always about learning here at the legislature, and we're just trying to understand. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to proceed with your presentation.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. I'm Chuck Johnson with the Department of Human Services. You have a handout that looks like this in your package that addresses the Child Care Development Fund provisions of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. This is simpler because we don't know very much yet, so maybe that'll make it easier. We expect, based on the estimates we've seen, that Minnesota will receive about $26 million in additional funding under the Stimulus Act for Child Care Development Fund. The sub-bullets break that down. There are two pieces that are directly targeted in the federal legislation. We estimate we'll get $2.2 million for a quality set-aside and $1.25 million for infant toddler targeted funds. So those are kind of quality that Deb Swenson-Klatt talked about, those kinds of dollars that will go directly to those activities. The remainder, $22.7 million, we believe is for assistance to low-income families, but there's a parenthetical there because we're unsure. Normally, anything under CCDF, 4% of it gets set aside for quality and development. In fact, they already set some money aside for quality and development. It may mean they're not going to do that, but it isn't clear to us right now how that's going to play out. But our expectation would be, at this point, that $22.7 million is probably for assistance to low-income families. As you're aware, this is one-time money. The provisions for CCDF require that we obligate the funds by September 30th of 2010 and that they be expended by a year after that date. We don't know a lot yet, but the statute legislation is very clear that the funds must be used to supplement, not supplant, state general fund revenues for child care assistance. We don't know what that means or how exactly the federal agency will define that. We assume there has to be some parameter given to us so that we can measure whether we're supplanting or not with whatever actions we take. At this point, we don't know what that'll be. We suspect that there'll be some way in which the federal agency will want us to report to them how we're using the dollars. It may be a CCDF plan amendment, but that's, again, just guessing at this point. That would be the normal way that this would work. The last section there just provides, normally, outside of if we were getting any other CCDF funds that were coming, for example, Ms. Kotelnik referenced, sometimes we get funds that other states underspend, we're able to capture those. Those we have ways of spending now under our current management practices. And for the kind of dollars here, the current management would be that the quality and development funds would go to activities as Ms. Swenson-Klatt described. Any additional dollars would go to the basic sliding fee program, where we would essentially increase the allocations to counties to eat into that waiting list that we have in the basic sliding fee program. We can't administratively do anything else, such as change the rates, change eligibility in the system. Those are all actions that we need legislature to be involved in, any kinds of changes that would expand the program in that way, the child care assistance program. So at this point, this is what we know about the funding. We expect that our first foray into how we'll use those dollars will come to you via the governor's supplemental budget, and it may involve looking at the quality dollars and the basic sliding fee or the assistance dollars, or we may treat those differently in how we approach it. But we haven't formulated a decision on that yet.
Mr. Johnson, any idea when that supplemental budget will be coming?
Madam Chair, I don't. It will be after the forecast, but I'm not sure exactly when.
Members, are there questions? Representative Greiling?
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, so you don't know, you don't have a fiscal year for the supplement. It's not supplant. Like in K-12, we have fiscal year 06. And then how will that play in, if you know, with the governor's touch to providers and so forth?
Manager Representative Growling, we don't have that. We expect that that may be what they'll use to set a base year of 07 or 08 or something, and basically hold us to maintenance of effort on the general fund in that year. But again, that's just speculation at this point. The forecast for child care assistance is, based on November forecast, is up in terms of the general fund dollars that are involved. So how and whether the proposal the governor's made to reduce rates would be impacted by this, we would need to see the February forecast, and we would need to understand what exactly the federal government means by supplements not supplant, what year they're using, to know if the already current law increase in child care assistance is not such that you could still make an adjustment to the rates and meet your MOE to get these dollars, or whether that would actually create a problem because we'd be making too big a reduction.
And then, Madam Chair, I should remember this, but Commissioner Johnson, how does this $26.1 million compare to how much did the governor cut altogether?
Madam Chair and Representative Greiling, I believe that the biennial reductions for the rate reduction and the copay increase were about $11 million for the biennium.
And Mr. Johnson, it's hard to get this all straight, would the governor's reduction still be on the table, or would they, you know, like in health care, the eligibility, they have to bring that back up before they can do it? Is it the same in child care, or do we know yet?
Madam Chair, I don't think we know for sure. There's no specific provision in the CCDF part of the Stimulus Act that says states can't reduce rates to providers or restrict eligibility, which there was in the case of Medicaid. It said it laid out specifically things states can't do in terms of eligibility and still receive the dollars. There isn't such a thing here, so as I was my exchange with Representative Greiling, it probably has more to do with how they define the supplement, not supplant provision, before we know what that would do in terms of impacting our ability to make other changes in the program.
So, Mr. Johnson, you know, there's a lot of talk around here about people preparing their budgets, but I mean, really, until the governor comes out with his supplemental budget, I think a lot of things are on hold. I mean, maybe I'm not really asking you to comment on that, but I would say members. It seems like it'd be very difficult for us to move ahead on much budgeting, as much as we sometimes hear the rhetoric and people want us to move ahead. We're all waiting again. We'll be waiting for the forecast, and then looks like we'll be waiting for the supplemental budget. And as you all know, we will be preparing a House budget. But I think we have to have those two pieces of information before we can really move ahead to any big extent. Any more questions?
Madam Chair, one comment I would add that it's a particularly complicated budget to put together because of understanding the effects of the stimulus. We may have to do that without completely understanding what the rules are on some of the pieces of the stimulus as well. We may or may not know by the time we're putting together the government supplemental budget exactly where the Child Care Bureau has landed on what this means. And so there may be then additional iterations as we go through session when we get more clarity from the federal government what's allowed and what isn't.
So, Mr. Johns, it's going to continue to be sort of blurry and come into focus more, and it sounds like it's going to take a while. Then for us to understand exactly how much funding we have. I'd say, you know, members, the good news is we have, you know, $26 million more. We just don't know how it interacts with the governor's budget and the forecast and everything else. So it will remain to be seen. Any other questions on Thursday? Again, we're going to adjourn early on Thursday at 5:30. If there's anything else in this bill, anything else, or on this testimony. And then we will be hearing a bill on Thursday as well, so we'll look for the testimony on that. With that, thank you, Mr. Johnson, and thank you, members, and we are adjourned.